and now a personal favourite of mine. Stay right here for another instalment from Documentally.
I've made it to the Open Rights Group's annual conference. ORGCon14 is the hashtag. Lots of people hustling and bustling, grabbing coffees as the day begins. Lots of interesting talks, security, whistleblowing, more security, the state of the internet. Looking forward to it. I think the last time we bumped into each other was the last Open Rights Group conference, and it is now 2014. William Heath.
The last one was a cracker. This one's going to be even better, I think. Yeah, nice to see you, Christian. How are you?
Really good. What's your role here today?
I'm chairing one of the sessions. They've got a terrific panel with three MPs, Claude Moraes, who's the MEP, chair of the Libor Commission committee, Julian Huppert, who's kind of the one MP who's got a clue about technology, and Natalie Bennett, who's the head of the Green Party. So that's, I'll just let them speak and let people ask questions.
The Green Party, are they allowed on the internet now?
Well, are they? I have to say, the good thing about an Open Rights Group conference is we're not scared of scientists, we're not scared of environmentalists, and we're not scared of Europe. We give them a platform.
Yeah,
like the MSM.
Yeah, exactly. It's been really interesting how how things have kind of panned out around publicity and who is being given a voice.
Yeah, and I think that's why the health of a grassroots activist organisation like ORG is so encouraging. And here we are Saturday, and it's sold out. Everyone's showing up, and everyone's keen, and we're looking forward to a great event.
Last time we chatted, we talked a little bit about MyDex. What's happening with MyDex?
MyDex is very busy. We think personal control over personal data, it's a meme where at one level it's game over. All the political parties agree with it. Tim Berners-Lee's come out very strongly in favour of it. Everyone agrees it should be done. And the bit that MyDex brings is it's implemented, it's live, we can do personal control of the personal data now, we could issue 55 million personal data stores tomorrow. And there's a powerful business model behind it. So we're very busy. I mean, a tech startup is it's always got certain pressures. If you're doing it as a social enterprise, there's a different set of challenges that you give yourself, but we're addressing those very happy, market's very lively, we're busy.
There's a number of places coming to light around the kind of, I wouldn't say protecting of one's data, but more control over one's data, data portability. How are you feeling about these systems, IndieWeb, for example?
Okay, so very much in favour of the IndieWeb campaign, which lets you acquire control over your content, your video, your sound, your blogging, your comments. I think it's really interesting to hear from Ben and Erin at Known how just a few months ago the IndieWeb vibe flipped from have your own website to acquire things from Twitter, Facebook and SoundCloud, Flickr to use your website as the place of origin for your content and then feed through. And I actually feel quite differently about Facebook and Twitter. If they have a big market valuation based on the fact they're a free advertising platform for content which I control, I'm okay with that. I don't feel so good if I'm sort of slave to my keyboard typing in content which gives them market value and I don't have control. So I think IndieWeb can make the other social platforms a lot healthier in a way. Now, MyDex is a counterpart to that, which does the structured data, the metadata if you want, or the data you need to fill out a form to get stuff done. So between the two, I think it's a very powerful combination.
How do we tackle things like licensing and the fact that you're submitting to many of these platforms are giving them pretty much unlimited rights to do whatever they want with that content?
I think you've got to do a really careful quality control in the terms and conditions of what happens with your data and content once you let it go. There's a huge emergence of services based on this theme of personal control of personal data. You have to check, do they really give you control? It's not control if you give your content or valuable personal data to a site that sells it, gives you a cut, but sells it to another site whose terms and conditions then prevail because you've lost control over it. And it's that. So our solution at MyDex to that is that any data sharing happens in a highly controlled way within a trust framework under a data sharing agreement where the rights remain with the individual.
Excellent. Look forward to your panel later on. I hope we can catch up then.
Thank you, Christian. Okay, cheers.
The Open Rights Group Conference, ORGCon14, if you are following a hashtag online. And I'm in the fortunate position to be sat opposite journalist, investigative journalist, Duncan Campbell. Can you give some background? Because I imagine your Wikipedia page is filled with triumph and adversity.
My website, which has an obvious name, Duncan Campbell, is the place to get the real information, a lot of the backstories. But I've been on the GCHQ and electronic surveillance beat for basically 40 years. Back in the 70s, wrote the first article about GCHQ, revealing its existence, its scale, and what it did. And as a result of some whistleblowing shortly afterwards, found myself in court one, our main court, the Old Bailey, being accused of espionage as well as receiving leaks. Fortunately, that fell apart, as did some initiatives from the government 10 or 12 years later when I was working for the BBC, exposing GCHQ's plans to get into spy satellites. And I was the person who first revealed the first mass surveillance project that these agencies got going with under the general codename of Echelon, which was when the West started getting communication satellites in the middle of the Cold War, massive resources to target those satellites, although they carried no communications of the Warsaw Pact. That should have been a clue, but when I wrote that article in 1987, nobody noticed.
Some say that your exposing of Echelon was kind of the first domino to topple in what were many revelations that came afterwards.
7 years afterwards, a very good New Zealand journalist did a lot of work and produced the first documentary information, based on stations and people in his own country. And that in turn led the European Parliament to investigate in 1999 and 2000, and to start developing the idea of a scale of mass surveillance. Their recommendations were substantial, but were buried within days by the attacks in New York and Washington and the consequences of that for most of Europe's foreign policy and security policy. Now we're back on the same beat again, but with the massive benefit of what Edward Snowden has put before us, which just shows completely clearly a surveillance apparatus way out of control.
So in many ways, what Edward Snowden did was popularise what otherwise appeared to be forum chatter and tinfoil hat-wearing individuals. Even though you yourself are a very experienced journalist, did you find that there was never enough leverage for the stories that you believe there should have been?
It's very difficult for people to understand these technically complex stories, and because the secrecy prevents people understanding when it may have impacted on life, politics or freedom, they're hard to get traction. The very word echelon has become one of these Area 51 type of terms. Most of the contexts in which I see echelon used on the web don't correctly relate to the project that was being described, which was a very specific system of intercepting satellites. It I think has passed out of use in the intelligence agencies now, although the main thing that they set up for the echelon project, which was satellite listening stations, precisely because they became very public as Echelon was exposed, they've used these as the place for burying the fibre cable tapping operations as well, because people are used to that. They don't realise a different kind of surveillance has been added in. The concepts of the mass surveillance and the scale of how far they went has shaken almost everybody in this business. If I look back on my own work, I can see that now, that partly because people were very disbelieving what I was suggesting was happening, I drew back from conclusions as to the likely scale of the surveillance, particularly in a 1919 investigation, which was showed that all of the Irish Republic's communications were under surveillance. The evidence I had then pretty much pointed to everything being taken, but I dared not do so. I didn't even dare believe that it went as far, it was as bad as that. But it was.
What drove you to focus on mass surveillance as opposed to other potentially more lucrative channels of journalism?
It just so happens that when I got started in journalism, one of the things I'd spotted was the British network of listening stations, and I wrote about it in Time Out magazine. A lot of American ex-NSA people were over in Britain because of the Vietnam War. They could tell us what it was about. And actually, as it turned out, in safety for them and us, because they were American whistleblowers, but GCHQ shared everything then as now, we could tell GCHQ's story based on secrets shared to the Americans.
So as a journalist today, without giving away your workflow in too much depth, what do you do to protect your personal communications, and how do you protect your sources?
Well, most of my communications, and actually most of my sources, don't require protection against the severe state-level intrusion that the signal intelligence agencies can organise. They're just not of interest. If I'm doing a story, for example, about offshore bank accounts, or indeed, as I was a couple of years ago, managing a big leaks project where we had all this data, I actually knocked the security down to a lower level because we were not doing anything that was inimical to the British and American governments. We also suspected they probably already got the data they had, and there was indications of that, and it turned out to be true. So when it's not appropriate, the security can get in the way. In the post-Snowden era, there's a fairly defined set of digital tools that people use to communicate securely. They're a nuisance, and they slow you up, they diminish the workflow, but if you're trying to protect the most critical pieces of information from the most aggressive of adversaries, they're appropriate. And they're all public and open source stuff, like Tails.
Please explain the box on the table.
I'm attending the Open Rights Group conference and made a point of showing to colleagues one of the tools of modern journalism, which is a biscuit tin. And the purpose of this biscuit tin, when taken to meetings, is to add a little bit of security by making sure that not only are phones turned off, but it's entirely possible for phones that are apparently switched off to be still functioning and transmitting. You put them inside a Faraday cage. So my biscuit tin, not quite a perfect Faraday cage because we haven't completed it, but it has a little picture of Michael Faraday on the front, and it basically does the right kind of job. On the other hand, if you were meeting with a source and you were both using smartphones and you stick your phones in my biscuit tin when you get to the meeting, it's really not much point, because unless you have paid assiduous attention to how the phones are set, they are leeching your position and movements at all times.
With what you know regarding, and what the general public should know now, regarding the mass surveillance of all of our communication channels down to physical mail, how do you keep your paranoia in check?
I'm not paranoid. I have a rational appreciation of the power of surveillance and also a keen sense of when it matters. So, for example, in an example I just gave you of dealing with offshore accounts and companies, I took the view that the Russian oligarchs or the Chinese oligarchs might not like this, and various corrupt people in different countries wouldn't like it. As far as the people in Britain are concerned with these secret bank accounts, if the security services were surveilling on our investigations and wanted to use that to go bust these people, I'd say go for it. As it was, our investigation showed that even though they'd managed to get the data, they'd insufficiently used it until we came along and started making it public. So it's a very nuanced world out there. There are people out there who have very reasonable fears that someone is trying to bring them down or diminish their lives, because that's exactly what's happening. There are a larger number of people with personality problems coming one's way. It's a question of keeping it's proportionate. What is repugnant, especially repugnant, is in the era of mass surveillance, that everyone's personal life is made a matter of secret record for potential surfacing and scrutiny at any later time for any later cause by anyone who has access to this. That is not the balance of human rights, liberty and security as we are promised, or as it's supposed to be, or as it is legislated for. They only get away with it because they keep it secret and seek to punish it or hurt those who would expose it. That has a big impact, because if you feel you are going to be at some stage the subject of surveillance, then the stuff that's really of no interest and no consequence is going to get swept up because they're targeting you. So family conversations, personal sensitivities, anything of that kind. If they want to get you, they get that stuff. That is not in the nature of paranoia, but in the nature of an unwelcome consequence of a gross intrusion.
Duncan Campbell, duncancampbell.org, your website. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Whenever I give a talk in the United States, the first talk I give is always a bit hallucinatory, because I'll have been up the whole night before with horrible jet lag, having flown over. And this was no exception. I was up at 3 in the morning in my hotel room in New York when I conceived of a way of talking about this stuff that I expressed as a law, Doctorow's Law. I called it very grandiose. It went over very well. And I went out to lunch the next day that day after giving the talk with my agent. And this is what you do if you're a writer in New York. You get a free lunch with your agent. It's kind of the bonus you get for the jet lag and what else, and all the rest of it. So I went out for lunch with my agent. He was a very nice guy. His name's Russell Galen. He was the agent for Arthur C. Clarke. And now he's the agent for Arthur C. Clarke's estate. And I said, Russ, I came up with a law for my talk today. And people loved it. And he said, you know, if there's one thing I learned representing Arthur, he said, you can't just have one law. You have to have three. So I have three laws. And that's how this talk is structured. It's around three laws that I think serve the arts and wider society well if we pay attention to them. And they're deliberately grandiose, and I will go through them now.
Can you give me your three laws that you talked about?
Sure. The first law is, when someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key, that lock isn't there for your benefit. So if you make your works available through any of the online platforms like Apple or Amazon, they will often give you the option, or sometimes require, that you add their digital rights management, their supposedly anti-piracy technology to it. It doesn't work very well at stopping piracy, but the law is structured so that only they can unlock it once you let them put their lock on it. And what that does is reduce your negotiating leverage with them. If they want more money than you're prepared to give them, and you say, okay, well, I'm going to use someone else to retail my works, they can keep your customers locked up inside their platform, which means it's harder for you to command more money from them. So we want to be sure that the people who make the works and invest in the works are first in line to get paid for them. And when you allow your stuff to be locked up with this platform technology, then you go to the back of the queue for money. The second law is that although fame won't make you rich, no one will give you money unless they've heard of your things. And so the way that people find out about our stuff and pay us for our stuff in the 21st century is using the internet. And the internet companies represent a kind of competitor of last resort to the increasingly consolidated entertainment industry, where if they offer you a bad contract, that contract still has to be better than the best contract you think you can get for yourself by walking out the door and doing your own thing. But when we raise the liability for them, when we say, oh, you must put in these very expensive anti-piracy measures, you must make it easy to remove content, and so on, all you do is block new entrants from the market. You don't actually reduce piracy. The entertainment industry are the first to remind us that despite having this multi-hundred million pound automated content ID system on YouTube, YouTube is still full of pirated content. But what it does do is mean that new YouTubes who might cause YouTube to give a better deal to the independent creators who go to them are less likely to emerge. And what that does is reduce our negotiating leverage with our publishers, with the people who invest in our works. If they offer us a bad deal, the deal that we get from YouTube is not going to be materially much better. And we've already seen that. YouTube has a streaming audio service where they've told independents that they must accept the same terms as the major labels. And if they don't like it, they're no longer welcome to use YouTube to host their music videos, which is a huge blow. So that's the second law. And then the third law is that information doesn't want to be free, but people do. Because the major impact of all of this stuff is not on the entertainment industry. The internet's not a glorified video on demand service. It's the nervous system of the 21st century, and everything we do is mediated by it. And when you allow material to be trivially censored without any penalties for misuse from the internet, the major impact of that is not on the arts, it's on everything, because the internet has everything, and it allows the King of Thailand and British neo-Nazis and the Church of Scientology to remove material that's critical of them without any penalties for abusing it. And when you add digital locks to things, and you start designing devices so that users aren't allowed to know what they're doing lest they use those devices in ways that runs contrary to the locks on them, what you do is you expose them to the risk that someone will figure out how to use those locks to attack them. Someone will use the fact that your computer is designed to hide its operations from you to covertly operate your camera or your microphone or do other things that compromise you in a million ways. And, you know, it's a real important junction right now, because the number of entities for whom the internet represents a problem rather than an opportunity has vastly expanded. And so the attacks on the internet are coming from every direction. There's subprime auto lenders who fit cars with governors that can disable their ignition if you miss your car payment. There's the FBI saying that all devices need to be have a program running on them that the FBI can access so they can listen in on an encrypted conversation that would otherwise be inaccessible to them. There's people worried about jihadi extremism who are saying that it should be even easier to censor the internet. And all of these things undermine the integrity of the internet and all the things we use it for, which is increasingly everything.
You finished with a great call to action, and that was not necessarily to abstain from a lot of the systems which are locking us in, locking the internet down, but to maybe consider the spending and how much we are investing in these organizations that are doing just that. Can you mention a few of the places you believe it would be very easy, and I have to agree, for people to redirect some of their spending so that we can protect the future of the internet?
Sure. Well, in the UK, obviously, there's the Open Rights Group, and I have to declare an interest because I co-founded it, but I don't get any money from it and never have. And I'm on its advisory board, but I'm not on its board of directors. There's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Free Software Foundation Europe, Article 19, Index on Censorship, Liberty, many other organizations, Amnesty and so on, who all work on these issues from different angles. And that's the amazing thing, is that because the internet is woven into the fabric of so much that we do, there are people who care about this for lots of different reasons, and so they're increasingly operating in coalition.
Cory Doctorow, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
So, lots of fascinating seminars. What is big tech doing about mass surveillance? Nothing to hide, nothing to fear. How do we get politicians to care about digital rights? Just a few of the titles that have happened at the Open Rights Group annual conference. Another fantastic event by a group well worth supporting. Check out openrightsgroup.org should you want to be a part of this ever-growing movement towards protecting our internet freedoms. This is important.